A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, Cannoneers and Cannonades. This is Daniel here just to remind you at the top of the show that the Cannonball is proud to be a part of Agora Podcast Network. Head on over to agorapodcastnetwork.com to check out a bunch of really great shows that if you like the Cannonball, I am certain you'll enjoy all of our sister shows over there. And relatedly, Agora Podcast Network podcasts are brought to you by Studio. Studio Sweden headphones. They are absolutely terrific. I can say so myself. I actually have a pair that I have been really enjoying over the last few weeks. Just absolutely the best sounding headphones I've ever had. I have the there are several styles available. I've been using the Trey earbud style, and super comfortable, stays in my stupid giant ears that everything else falls out of. Absolutely a superior headphone. Whether you're listening to someone like me drone on podcasts or audiobooks, it even sounds great for music. A lot of earbuds don't, but these sound absolutely terrific. There are there's full earphones, other varieties of earbuds over Studio. All Bluetooth enabled, all have great battery life. Just a terrific, just terrific for any audiophile out there. So check out studio.com, SUDIO.com. And since you are a listener to the Cannonball, you are going to have access to a special 15% off discount code. And pay attention, y'all, because this is super secret just for you guys. C-A-N-N-O-N-B-A-L-L. That's Cannonball, but spelled like the gun instead of the thing we're talking about. That's a secret little, it's just a little secret for you guys to make sure that only the true Cannonball fans get that amazing 15% off over at studio.com. Check them out.
Welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. This is Dr. Claude Myron Guzer coming at you with a little less voice than I usually have. And with me is Daniel Doherty, my partner in crime, who is also coming to you with less voice than he usually has.
less voice, but I'm at that part in a head cold where I get a nice basso timbre. And I'm really into. I don't know how much this podcast mic is picking up, but I got to tell you, it feels pretty good to have the old rumble in the voice box here. But yeah, so apologies in advance for any sniffling. I'm trying to be very cognizant of that. But it is the season, and we both have young children, and so we're constantly exposed to every disease vector you can think of. So
exactly, and so this episode is coming in a little bit late, but we're dealing with Montaigne, and if anything, this is a reminder that we are human. So
if Montaigne's good for anything, it's a reminder that as scattered and human as we can be, you can be even more scattered and human and be considered a genius.
Oh, goodness. All right. So tonight we're sort of taking on book two, and we figured the best way to do this is actually not to take on book two.
The thing about book two is that it's utterly dominated by what is easily the longest essay in the whole, in his whole essays series, yeah. Right? Yeah.
The apology for Raymond Sebone, which takes up sort of a central space in book two and in the essays. Like there's nothing this sustained in all of the essays. And like you said, it sort of takes up a huge chunk of space. So we figured a lot of the stuff around it is very, very close to the kinds of meditations on death that we had approached sort of last time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the function of philosophy, what it means to think, so on and so forth. So we figured that this, we could do a sort of sustained reading of this one essay and then move on to book three later. So that's what we're going to try to do tonight as much as we possibly can. Now, before we get to that, I did have something that I wanted to address. And we didn't really cover it too much last time. You know, we were focusing sort of on the parts of Montaigne that we were a little more enamored of. Mm-hmm. But there's something that comes through in book two that's really, well, it's problematic, and it's his misogyny. Mm-hmm. There's no other way to say it than to be frank. And I suppose if we're dealing with Montaigne, we're dealing with being as frank as possible.
Yeah. But, whom among us is shocked at the, at an element of misogyny in the writings of a Western tradition philosopher? My goodness. Never have I heard of such a thing. He said sarcastically.
Yeah. So, for me, it was disruptive this time around.
Yeah.
Looking at it, this time around, meaning in this section of essays that we were looking at, there are a couple of essays early on where he sort of regurgitates some of the no means yes discourse of the 16th century. It's really discomforting stuff about how. Okay, this is not me, this is Montaigne. Mm-hmm. It's really discomforting stuff where he claims that some women enjoy rape because it allows them to still protest and yet enjoy the act at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
There's in particular a whole essay, that difficulty increases desire, where he plays on that trope again. It's sort of a really disgusting trope that was commonplace, you know, up even into the 18th century, that women say no but mean yes, and that the whole point of coquettishness, or what he claims is coquettishness, is to stimulate desire in men.
Yeah.
It was hard to take.
What I thought was interesting about that particular essay, the that our desires are augmented by difficulty, is that he couches that particular sort of, I don't know what you would call it, sort of sex domination angle in a sort of wider, you know, like you said, we're making this wider point that, like, I guess I always heard the proverb growing up, hunger is the best sauce, you know, like this kind of like when you have to really struggle for it and work for it, it makes it all the sweeter. And taking that kind of, you know, that kind of broad point, you know, talking about, you know, various and sundry different endeavors, and then sort of applying it to, like, yeah, and when you really have to, you know, when you really have to overcome a woman's objections, it's like, oh, good Lord, no. That's a completely... He doesn't sort of recognize the that, you know, when you bring another thinking, feeling human being into the mix, that there's a different dynamic going on rather than just, you know, your satisfaction being you know, sharpened by this struggle.
And so I know I was discomforted by that, but I honestly would be curious to know what any women listeners really felt about that.
Mm-hmm. Cause we're both, you know, we're both, you know, we're both men. We're both, you know, male identifying people. And so I'm absolutely certain that there are aspects and angles that just, you know, just fly right over my head. Well, but yeah,
one of the things that I would, that I wish we could do more effectively is have other voices in, and mm-hmm. we're trying to arrange that down the road. Because that is an important part of understanding, you know, how the stuff operates. What am mm-hmm. I missing? How might someone else from a different perspective read this or think about this? And I really would like to hear what some people who are sort of on the other end of this would feel about this. And I know that people are reading along. So if anybody has any insights into, you know, what this was like, was this disruptive? Was this something that you could overlook and pass off as, well, times have changed, even though, you know, honestly, they haven't. You know?
Right. They have not changed nearly as much as we might think. Yeah.
Well, you know, when I was a younger man, I think I would have just dismissed this as being, you know, of his time, but as I've gotten older, the more I see it's not. Mm-hmm. And I would be curious if I would be curious about the experiences of anybody reading this. Part of what this is an experiential podcast or an experiential attempt to read literary works, an affective attempt. I was really sort of appalled mm-hmm. and frankly disgusted by some of this, and it shaded the reading of some of the other things, but mm-hmm. I would like to know, you know, how other people sort of encountered it. So that's, you know, if anybody has any insights, you know, let us know.
Because next month we'll still be on Montaigne. We'll be rounding out Montaigne with the third book of essays. So it'll still be on topic. We'd like to read anyone's anyone's thoughts on it.
Okay, so I guess that moves us into the apology itself. Now, mm-hmm. okay. Seban was a thinker and a writer who had written a tract. I'm not quite sure I completely got what exactly Seban was up to. Do you have more of a handle on that?
Yeah, I can place this sort of in the context of the times. So Seban was, I mean, honestly, without Montaigne having written an essay with his name in it, I doubt I would have ever heard of this guy, but he was important at the time. He was a basically kind of a what were at the time called natural philosopher, sort of a thinker in was from Barcelona, if I recall. His Catalonian was his sort of national background, but he was a faculty member at the University of Toulouse in what is today southern France, and what was at the time much more culturally connected with the Catalonian region in what is today Spain, that actually had a dialect continuum. But that's getting way off base already. So Raymond Seban was a guy who wrote a tract in the 1400s that was called Natural Theology or Book of Creatures. And his main thrust in writing it was he was basically sort of writing in a at this time well-established vein, because he was basically echoing Thomas Aquinas, who by the 15th century had pretty much been accepted as the official sort of natural philosophy doctrine of the Catholic Church, of the Western Latin Church. But the main thrust of his work was that you could discover facts about theology. You could discover things about the nature of God. You could discover things about the nature of the true reality of the universe, not just via the testament of Scripture, but also via the testament of creation itself. His reasoning being that, you know, creation is, you know, what is the first and, you know, most obvious testament to the Creator God? Well, that would have to be the creation itself. And, you know, and second would be, of course, his revealed word, which, you know, clarified some things too. In the vision of the, you know, the Latin Christian West, you know, his revealed word in the Old Testament and the New Testament, which clarified a few things. But you could start at the natural world and come to these sort of using reason, using rational inquiry, you could come to these you know, the conclusions that would be supported by scripture as well. Which was a very well, this was, of course, this was Thomas Aquinas' big project. This was his marriage of the Aristotelian empiricism. I'm using big air quotes for that. But basically the idea that all knowledge must ultimately be based on some sort of sensory input. That's what we would call empiricism.
Right.
But sort of wedding that Aristotelian natural philosophy with the revealed truths of Catholic dogma and Catholic doctrine, and making the point that, like, oh, these are in seamless harmony. Because, of course, if truth is truth, and we know truth from looking at the world, and we know truth from the received wisdom of the church, then because they're both true, then it has to be, you know, completely in harmony. And, oh, look at that, you know, and don't mind that, you know, sort of papered over crack in the corner over there. So in Montaigne's day, this was, I believe Montaigne encountered the text because he was asked to translate it into French, because it had been written in a kind of Catalonian inflected Latin. And so he had been, I think it was his father himself, wasn't it? Had asked him, you know, his father had this, you know, great library, and he was like, you know what? I really like this Raymond Saban guy. I think here would be a good project for you, kid. Translate this, this dense natural theology text. So that's where Montaigne encounters this guy. And so in his apology for Raymond Saban, what he's doing is ostensibly, again with Montaigne, we always have to say, like, ostensibly what this essay is about, you know, is different from what it actually ends up being about. But ostensibly what he's doing is answering some challenges to the sort of to the philosophical arguments that Saban is making. And he's specifically answering challenges from the kind of the reforming end of Western Christendom. He's answering challenges from the Lutherans, sort of most basically. And of course, by the mid 1500s, the Lutherans have been joined by, there's the Anabaptist reformers who are a little more radical. Those are the radical reformers who actually kind of made Luther respectable, honestly. The Lutherans could point to the Anabaptists and say, look, at least we aren't those guys. So let us, you know, leave us alone and we'll be okay. John Calvin was starting to sort of cultivate his vision of Reformation. So there were a number of sort of objections specifically to what's called the scholastic tradition.
Right.
Which sort of Saban is kind of a B-League scholastic, basically. You know, he's a B-League Thomist. But Montaigne apparently had enough of a soft spot that he wrote his longest, most widely ranging essay as a way of answering these challenges to why, actually, no, Raymond Saban he did make good thinks, and you should think his thinks are good.
Well, I think you're getting to part of the issue. is that this is a wide-ranging essay. And if this is a defense of Saban, you might miss that fact.
He's barely mentioned at all. Like, at all. It's astonishing.
So I think what we're going to try to do is just dive into some of the relative bits and pieces to pick out how it's operating, what exactly he's saying. And the thing is, this operates like a shorter essay of his, just bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same, you know, he's going to make a proposition, digress, give you 23 examples of something that proves the digression, somehow meander his way back to some kind of central point, end up with some bizarre analysis of some weird habit he's had since he was 12, give you an appreciation of a horse he once saw, and then come to the conclusion, I guess this proves my point, but what do I know?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's kind of like it's kind of like, you know, when like an author gets like big enough for his britches that the editor or the publisher can't really tell him no anymore.
Yeah.
Can't really, if the author doesn't want to be edited, you know, it just doesn't happen. This is sort of reads like, you know, Montaigne off unleashed. He's off the leash. Whatever editor he might have had was on vacation that week. And so he's just going hog wild.
All right. So there are a couple of things, though, or a couple of points that we've sort of been discussing that really sort of shine through. And one is how this reveals some of the paradoxical aspects of his politics. There's another way in which his seeming sometimes embrace of Pyrrhonism sounds an awfully lot like deconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And then the comparisons of the human to the animal, which...
Right, as a way of sort of demonstrating why humans aren't hot shit.
Yeah.
Like, don't think you're so great, because everything you think is unique to humans actually isn't. And here I'm going to show, you know, XYZ. It's probably the most, like... It's the most fun section of the essay, because it is, you know, it's pretty closely observed with a lot of these, you know, a lot of these animals.
Yeah. So I guess we can just, those are sort of like three major things. And then mm-hmm. we'll have, you know, as he throws stuff our way, we'll have other slight observations that we have. And then I guess the only thing to do is just sort of dive in. So
yeah.
I wrote about 70 theses.
We're going to nail them to Montaigne's door.
I annotated 70 small bits or passages, and we're not going to get through all of them, but I think in our sickened state, we can get through enough to kill an hour.
Sure.
So why don't we try that? Now, the first thing that struck me was pretty close to the beginning, where he's justifying having a book like Saban's in the public. And he says, "The mass of ordinary people lack the faculty of judging things as they are, letting themselves be carried away by chance appearances. Once you've put into their hands the foolhardiness of despising and criticizing opinions which they used to hold in the highest awe, such as those which concern their salvation, and once you have thrown into the balance of doubt and uncertainty any articles of their religion, they soon cast all the rest of their beliefs into similar uncertainty. They had no more authority for them, no more foundation than for those you have just undermined. And so, as though it were the yoke of a tyrant, they shake off all those other concepts which had been impressed upon them by the authority of law and the awesomeness of ancient custom." Now, this is an interesting moment, because what he's doing is basically saying, at least as I'm interpreting this, not mm-hmm. everyone can do what I do. On the one hand, his dictum, you know, what do I know? There's a profound uncertainty at the heart of every human endeavor. Truth, as he sort of sets out to show, is often quite relative. Any proposition that you can make, the opposite of it is also likely to be true. Okay, these are things that he values, and yet he starts off by saying, well, most people can't handle that, because if they see doubt in one place, they'll see doubt everywhere and throw off the authority that should keep them in line.
Yeah.
So this intellectual doubt, which seems like a liberating thing, can also be threatening in this other weird kind of way. It's a doubt that he sees leading others to a kind of false liberation, but a doubt which keeps him sort of conservatively aligned to arbitrary forms of authority that he recognizes are arbitrary.
Yeah.
But he just goes with them.
Like, it's almost a kind of it's like a utilitarian vision of authority and truth.
Yeah.
Like it's almost like, look, you know, sure, we can reject received authority, but that would be chaos. Who knows? You know.
Yeah. And so that gets at the sort of weirdly frustrating aspect of some of his politics, that it, on the one hand, it looks as if this is sort of freeing the mind from certain kinds of cant. On the other, it frees it from cant just to capitulate to systems that it recognizes are flawed.
Right, right. It's a kind of it's kind of intellectual cover for reconciling yourself to. I mean, what was oh goodness, I know it's a Mark Twain quote, but I forget which like character is in it. It might be like a Huckleberry Finn or something. But the Mark Twain quote was, "Faith is believing what you know ain't so."
Yeah,
and I think that's a folksy way to put Montaigne's point there. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that comes fairly early in the essay, and that just opens up some of these issues that we're going to have throughout it. But I suppose keep that on the back burner. All right. So he starts making the claim that where is it? That in some ways the supernatural has to be the thing that keeps us in conjunction. Mm. The knot which ought to attach our judgment and our will and to clasp our souls firmly to our Creator should not be one tied together with human considerations and strengthened by emotions. It should be drawn tight in a clasp both divine and supernatural, and have only one form, one face, one luster, namely the authority of God and His grace. So again, we're back to this issue of the idea of authority, but it's also Montaigne sort of weirdly capitulating to the supernatural. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, he's so fascinated by the pragmatic, what we can know based on our experience. But here, he seems to be making some kind of foundational claim that it's what we can't know which pulls everything together. It's something that we can't understand, or something which escapes human comprehension.
Right, and something which is outside of human experience, utterly.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I think if we had to pick one sort of through thread for this essay, it's that insistence that that human reason is actually incapable of comprehending things properly, which is again odd because he's supposed to be defending Saban against these accusations that sound a lot like that.
Right. I mean, that's what's kind of frustrating, but also kind of fascinating. You know, he gets to this part towards the end where he's making all kinds of claims about how all the promises of heaven are innately false, because if we go there when we're dead, then it means we're not material anymore. So there can be no material basis to prepare us for what the experience of the afterlife is like.
Yeah.
And that becomes foundational for him.
Yeah, that was a fascinating part to me, because he ends up, if I recall correctly, he leads into this with a kind of a discussion of the as he understands it, the Islamic vision of paradise,
yes,
that would await true believers. And he makes the point that it's like, look, I mean, everyone, you know, can only, all they're ever imagining is just this terrestrial life, but better. Because that's all they can imagine, because that's all that they have, because of all they really have is empirical observation.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I always go to Beckett because I just know Beckett so well. But there's a late, it's actually Beckett's last novel called Worshward Ho, where it's a mind trying to imagine the best worst thing, like what's the least most thing a mind can imagine until there's nothing left so that it can stop.
Yeah.
And it's written in this kind of weird superlative game, and it starts out on, say on, be said on, somehow on, till know how on, said know how on, go, somehow on, somehow keep going, till know how on, i.e. till you stop, said know how on, presumed stopping, but what's beyond the stop we don't and can't know. And that seems to be what Montaigne is getting at. And in this weird way, it's that lack of knowledge which for him is foundational.
Yeah. Yeah.
But let's talk for a while about why human beings are less than animals.
This was clearly the Yeah, and this is clearly, I think this is like the fun portion, and this is also the most famous,
yeah,
I think, portion of the entire essays. And I thought that it was also interesting that the apology is, I believe that it's really, I think it's the only, I think maybe Of Cannibals also gets published separately, but yeah, the apology is one of the very few essays which ever gets published in an edition on its own. Like, yeah, part of the collection of essays. And I think it's part of it on the strength of this portion where he's demonstrating that, like, look, human reason itself is never going to be up to the task because mm-hmm. human beings themselves are not superior beings. They are not, they imagine themselves to be between God and the animals, but they aren't. And this, I think, was pretty interesting because in a way, it's a refutation of the extremely Aristotelian notion of the great chain of being, which was also an extremely Catholic notion.
Yeah.
Because of Aristotle, because of Thomism. But this is a sort of an extended kind of demolishing of that notion. Or rather, I guess, like placing it like, look, sure, there's a great chain of being, but God is so far beyond it that it doesn't even matter.
Yeah. And so he has this line. So let us consider for a while man in isolation, man with no outside help, armed with no arms but his own, and stripped of that grace and knowledge of God in which consist his dignity, his power, and the very ground of his being. Let us see how much constancy there is in all his fine panoply. Let man make me understand, by the force of discursive reason, what are the grounds on which he has founded and erected all those advantages which he thinks he has over other creatures, and who has convinced him that it is for his convenience, his service, that, for so many centuries, there has been established and maintained the awesome notion of the vault of heaven, the everlasting light of those tapers coursing proudly overhead, or the dread surging of the boundless sea. Is it possible to imagine anything more laughable than that this pitiful, wretched creature, who is not even master of himself but exposed to shocks on every side, should call himself master and emperor of a universe, the smallest particle of which he has no means of knowing, let alone swaying? He takes humanity to task right off the bat and just accuses humankind of the utmost vanity. The natural original distemper of man is presumption. Man is the most blighted and frail of all creatures, and moreover, the most given to pride. This creature knows and sees that he is lodged down here among the mire and shit of the world, bound and nailed to the deadest, most stagnant part of the universe, in the lowest story of the building, the farthest from the vault of heaven. His characteristics place him in the third and lowest category of animate creatures, yet, in thought, he sets himself above the circle of the moon, bringing the very heavens under his feet. The vanity of this same thought makes him equal himself to God, attribute to himself God's mode of being, pick himself out and set himself apart from the mass of other creatures, and, although they are his fellows and his brothers, carve out for them some such helpings of force or faculties as he thinks fit. How can he, from the power of his own understanding, know the hidden inward motivations of animate creatures? What comparison between us and them leads him to conclude that they have the attributes of senseless beasts? And then comes the punchline, when I play with my cat, how do I know that she is not passing time with me rather than I with her? So,
yeah,
it's... What he's sort of assaulting here, I think, is the presumption of reason, which is sort of ironic because he's been using philosophy this whole time to allow him to make peace with death and dying.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout this essay, well, philosophy, it's just a presumption.
Yeah. Well, honestly, speaking of this kind of philosophical irony, there's a kind of wider, I noticed it in reading the apology, that there's a wider irony, especially in the apology, in Montaigne's whole project. And it goes back to humanism.
Yeah.
And when we don't mean humanism in the sense of kind of its contemporary usage, meaning, like an atheistic consideration of human beings as being equally worthy and capable of good things. Humanism in the context of the Renaissance was, the term goes back to this sort of medieval splitting of all literature between the divinities, which is that literature concerning God and divinity, and humanities, which is literature about anything else and everything else. Or rather human concerns and human affairs. And what was going on, humanism was this huge intellectual vogue, which had set itself up in opposition to the scholasticism of people like Sabond, Which was a very staid, a very formalized, a very rote kind of thinking that was very much based on the kind of like rigorous, logical, step-by-step thinking. Humanism, which got us a big shot in the arm with the Western Europe getting access to a ton of works from classical antiquity, thanks to the refugee scholars from Byzantium. Because, you know, don't get me started on Byzantium, but in a many centuries process, which had come to a head by the early 1400s with the Ottoman Turkish state sort of eclipsing it. All of the classical, you know, works of classical antiquity that had been sort of preserved by scholars in the Eastern Mediterranean world, thanks to those scholars having to flee to the Western Mediterranean world, became accessible to the scholars of the Latin West. And so there was this big vogue for reading all of those, what had been classified in the humanities, in this division between divinities and humanities, and finding that, like, hey, you know, maybe, you know, there's stuff we can learn here. There's wisdom here. We can use this stuff. And that's what Montaigne does all throughout his essays, because all of his essays are sprinkled with these quotations from the classical authors.
Right, right.
And it's not theological authors. It's classical, you know, quote unquote, secular authors, or rather like non-theological authors. And it's a tradition, whereas scholasticism sort of venerated the, I guess what you might call sort of systematized rational discourse, humanism was much more interested in rhetoric,
right,
as an actual vehicle of truth. Not, you know, we might consider that sophistry, to borrow a term of classical antiquity, but that was a very real thing that the humanists were doing. And that's what Montaigne is doing. He's using, he's relying on the authority, he's relying on this vogue of finding wisdom in the classical authors to support this supposition that actually humans can't offer anything.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's, I guess we'll get into it in a little bit, but that seems to be his elevation of Pyrrhonism. Even if it is an elevation, it seems to me he's hedging his bets a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't think he wants to completely say, hey, we should all be Pyrrhonists, but he gives them enough credit that it seems like that's at least how he finds value in some of the writers that he's reading.
Yeah. And for the sake of folks at home and possibly folks on the other end of this call, what's the sort of quick and dirty definition of Pyrrhonism?
As far as I understand it, I don't have much of a handle on it at all, but as far as I understand it, it was a philosophy in antiquity that sort of argued against itself. What it was trying to do was show the relativity of all truth claims to produce this state of paradox called ataraxia, which is a kind of, I guess the best way to think about it is that sort of blissful non-thinking state produced by a Zen koan.
Okay.
To meditate on it enough so that the rational thinking mind shuts down and you find a kind of meditative peace. As Montaigne uses them, what he seems to be getting at is this idea that all of these rhetorical truths that everybody is writing in antiquity or around him, these rhetorical truths are always equally true. So you can frame a statement that has a truth claim. You can also frame the opposite statement, and both statements, if framed accurately and adequately, will cancel each other out more or less.
Yeah.
Now, this has a parallel with 20th century deconstruction. And I'm
clearly
by no means the first to make this parallel. I think this has been this has long been an observation in the field. Now, deconstruction, though, it doesn't, as far as I understand it, and I'm not an expert here, I've done enough of Derrida and Daman to get a taste of it.
Yeah.
And that taste that's enough for me. Yeah. But as far as I understand, what Derrida more or less was trying to do was something similar, but rather than resting in this kind of meditative Zen space, it's about the restlessness. It's about acknowledging how we're constantly shuttling between meanings, mm-hmm. that no one meaning is stable, and it's all about the sort of shiftiness and the necessary shiftiness.
Right,
the,
and it and
the
how
play between signifiers and not the rest.
Right, and that is kind of his way of setting up how then that is the necessity of supernatural intervention, basically. Yeah.
Well, like Derrida doesn't say that, but Montaigne does.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, no, yeah, I'm sorry. To say that's the setup for Montaigne to say that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that if all of this stuff is constantly sliding, then we always only have recourse to the higher authority. And that's actually the critique that people have been making of deconstruction for a long time. Even when it was sort of first starting out, there was a mode of critique that wanted to say this is a sort of reactionary conservatism in disguise. Because at the end of the day, if all you're doing is embracing the fluid energy that moves back and forth that never rests, then you're opening the door to not really challenging authoritarian power structures, but reifying them.
Mm-hmm.
Just by capitulating to them, because there is nothing else. Anyway, that's the critique.
As you can see, dear listener at home, when we said this was wide ranging and touched on a lot of stuff, we were not kidding.
Do you want me to go to the part where he talks about philosophers farting or why doggy style is the best kind of sex? Because that also is in here. This is Montaigne we're talking about.
Yeah.
But he works all of this sort of all together. And I guess to bring it back, he just gives this catalog of why humans really can't cut it. He talks about human desires. He says desires are either natural and necessary, like eating and drinking, natural and not necessary, such as mating, or else neither natural nor necessary, like virtually all human ones, which are entirely superfluous and artificial.
Yeah.
Nature needs wonderfully little to be satisfied and leaves little indeed for us to desire. The activities of our kitchens are not nature's ordinance. Stoics say that a man could feed himself on one olive a day. The choiceness of our wines owes nothing to nature's teachings any more than do the refinements we load onto our sexual appetites. This is almost Montaigne, like, okay, throughout this section or throughout this essay, I keep having Montaigne the this or Montaigne the that. This seems to be Montaigne, almost the Marxist, who wants to say, well, it's the system which convinces us that we have a need or desire.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at what we actually need and desire, it's really rather simple.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Like this kind of, this kind of puncturing of these vanities that, of course, he would be intimately familiar with his contact with the kind of courtly culture of the time. You know,
exactly.
He had been a diplomat. He had seen the, I'm sure, intense backbiting over who got to stand where, when Henry of Navarre holds court or what have you.
Right. So he makes a run through war. As for war, the most grandiose and glorious of human activities, I would like to know whether we want to use it to prove our superiority or, on the contrary, to prove our weakness and imperfection. We know how to defeat and kill each other to undermine and destroy our own species. Not much there, it seems, to make them want to learn from us, i.e. not much that animals can learn from us. He punctures that presumption. And then there's this weird moment where he says, the souls of emperors and cobblers are cast in the same mold. Mm-hmm. We consider the importance of the actions of princes and their weight, and then persuade ourselves that they are produced by causes equally weighty, equally important. In that we deceive ourselves. They are tossed to and fro by the same principles as we are. The reasons that make us take issue with a neighbor lead princes to start a war. The same reason which makes us flog a lackey makes kings lay waste a province. They can do more, but can wish as lightly. The same desires trouble a fleshworm and an elephant. So, you know, on the one hand, there's the authoritarian impulse in Montaigne. On the other, there's this kind of leveling of all human activity. Look, there's no one of us who really operates on a different level than any of the others.
Yeah, it's a kind of like, you know, saying, you know, there's Montaigne the Marxist. I think this is, you know, Montaigne the Bakuninite anarchist.
Yeah.
Like this. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, you can go through the essay and you find these moments that are really fascinating because they open up certain kinds of, well, like I said, levelings. But at the same time, he keeps veering back and forth between there's this tearing down of all these structures and the possibility of a kind of mental liberation from those structures. But it's only ever going to be a mental liberation, and it only goes so far when it turns back to capitulate to an authoritarian order. So he gives us a rundown of why philosophy itself is even vain and why we shouldn't even do it in the first place. And so he says, now even that share in nature's favor which we do concede to the animals is much to their advantage, to ourselves we attribute goods which are purely imaginary and fantastical, future absent goods which it exceeds our human capacity of itself to vouch for, or else they are goods which our unruly opinions attribute to ourselves quite wrongly, such as knowledge, rationality, or preeminence. We abandon to animals a share in solid palpable goods which really do exist, peace, repose, security, innocence, health. Health, the fairest, finest gift that nature can bestow. So we trade calmness, security, health for philosophy and thinking and abstract reasoning and self-awareness and self-consciousness, and it just leads us down the wrong road. That is why even Stoic philosophy dares to assert that Heraclitus, who had dropsy, and Pheresides, who had been infested by lice, would have been right, if they could, to barter their wisdom against a cure. By weighing and comparing wisdom against health, they make it even more splendid than in another of their assertions. Supposing Circe, they say, had presented Ulysses with two different potions, one to make a madman wise, the other a wise man mad. Rather than allow her to transform him from human to beast, he ought to have accepted the one that would make him mad. Wisdom herself, they say, would have argued like this. Leave me, forsake me, rather than lodge me in the bodily shape of an ass. What? Will philosophers forsake wisdom great and divine to cleave to the veil of this earthly body? So we do not, after all, excel over beasts by wit and our power of reason, but merely by our physical beauty, our beautiful color, the beautiful way our members are arranged. For things like that, we must forsake our intellect, our moral wisdom, and whatnot. This sounds like Swift. This sounds like Gulliver's Travels, where in the sort of famous fourth book of Gulliver's Travels that few people actually read, Gulliver ends up on the island of the horses, who are so absolutely pragmatically rational that they don't even have a word for lie. For them, it is saying the thing that is not. And Gulliver is so transformed on that island that when he goes back to England, he can't behave like a normal human anymore. He wishes he was a horse. This is sort of Montaigne saying, wouldn't it be more rational to trade humanity for being a horse or being a mule? Because the rest is just vanity.
I think this is among the most self-refuting, and we're talking about Montaigne, so he's prone to self-refutation constantly, and here he is, like, sort of this he's establishing a using his human reason, establishing an argument why we shouldn't bother with paying attention to anyone's reasonable human argument.
Exactly.
And I absolutely adore it. I am here for it 100%.
I mean it's just so bizarre.
Yeah.
Right. But anyway, so he walks us through why humanity is lacking, essentially. And it all sort of comes down to our vanity that we can know something above and beyond what is actually there.
Right? And I should hasten to point out that this is this is part of his defense against people saying Saband has weak arguments. His defense of Saband's weak arguments are saying, like, look, pal, no one has good arguments.
Okay.
And at a very basic level, which is why it goes into, like, how human beings are, you know, not much better than animals. And, like, you know, and this Pyrrhonist sort of radical epistemology he's working with.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Yeah. Okay. So then I have another moment. This is the Freudian Montaigne, where he's talking about basically the pain in pleasure. For even that tickling excitement which accompanies certain pleasures and which seems to exalt us above mere good health and freedom from pain, that shifting delight, active, inexplicably biting and sharp, aims in the end at freedom from pain. The appetite which enraptures us when we lie with women merely aims at banishing the pain brought on by the frenzy of our inflamed desires. All it seeks is rest and repose, free from the fever of passion. That is extraordinarily close to Freud in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, mm-hmm. where Freud makes this claim that he shifts his earlier claims that what we wanted was we want sex for procreation, and so the sex drive is the primary drive. And what he ends up saying is, no, that's just a cover for this nihilistic drive to self-destruction within us.
Yeah.
And he changes his wording where he says that arousal is displeasure and the state of blissly release from consciousness in physical terms, bodily orgasm, is the true pleasure. So it's what Montaigne would call tickling excitement,
right?
That desire, that sort of self-perpetuating to the point of no return, or I guess not self-perpetuating, but that sort of that sort of perpetuating to the point of no return that keeps falling back on itself to increase the intensity of sensation. That's right there in Montaigne. I was honestly kind of surprised to see that.
Yeah.
Because Freud treats it as his greatest insight. And here it's sort of like, well,
it's a tossed off, observation in the middle of him trying to say that this Catalonian scholar's book is actually pretty good.
Yeah. And it's a cast off observation or a tossed off observation that sort of, could incite a whole field of psychological studies.
Yeah.
Here's another tossed off observation, which seems like the kernel for Proust's 3,000 page novel. Memory reproduces what she wants, not what we choose. Indeed, there is nothing which stamps anything so vividly on our memory as the desire not to remember it. The best way to impress anything on our souls and to make them stand guard over it is to beg them to forget it. He says in three sentences what Proust takes like seven volumes to get to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's that, but that is In Search of Lost Time right there. Okay. So we're sort of just jumping through here, and one of the more fascinating things for me is his one more thing. Philosophy lays down the law on this subject in these words: if some great evil should chance upon you, one you cannot remedy, then a haven is always near. Swim out of your body as from a leaky boat. Only a fool is bound to his body not by love of life but by fear of death. He has this justification for suicide, which is really kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
That seems to be not in line with an argument for Catholic doctrine.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, he gets to this part where there's this sort of extended discussion about how we lack the reason, or we lack the ability really to contemplate God at all. And he says, it is so far beyond our power to comprehend the majesty of God that the very works of our Creator which best carry his mark are the ones we least understand. To come across something unbelievable is, for Christians, an opportunity to exercise belief. It is all the more reasonable precisely because it runs counter to human reason. If it were reasonable, it would not be a miracle. If it followed a pattern, it would not be unique. Okay, do you follow that?
I think I followed. I'm going to have a hard time sort of paraphrasing it, but like I guess the idea being that it is, if one is being asked to believe something extraordinary, then it must necessarily, in order for that to be believable, it must necessarily assail your notions of believability so much that you have no choice but to believe it. That also is completely paradoxical, and I don't I don't know. Yeah. But I think I get what he's saying there, that like, you know, if and in a way it's almost a kind of mystic approach.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a kind of like, look, if these things made any sense, they wouldn't be profound. Or there wouldn't, you know, it's not, you know, who said the truth had to be apprehensible to you in the way you prefer, I guess. Yeah.
And so then there's this is really kind of fascinating because he absolutely dismantles the very idea of a recognizable divinity. He
yeah.
says, we confidently use words like might, truth, justice. They are words signifying something great. What that something is, we cannot see or conceive. We say that God fears, that God is angry, that God loves, but there are disturbances and emotions which in any form known to us find no place in God, nor can we imagine them in forms known to him. God alone can know himself. God alone can interpret his works, and he uses improper human words to do so, stooping down to earth where we lie sprawling. Take prudence, that consists in a choice between good and evil. How can that apply to God? No evil can touch him. Or take reason and intelligence, by which we seek to attain clarity amidst obscurity. There is nothing obscure to God. Or justice, which distributes to each his due, and which was begotten for the good of society and communities of men. How can that exist in God? And what about temperance? It moderates bodily pleasures which have no place in the Godhead.
Yeah.
Nor is fortitude, in the face of pain, toil, or danger, one of God's qualities. Those three things are unknown to him. There you go. That explains why Aristotle held that God is equally as free from virtue as from vice.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What is divinity then?
And I think here he's sort of, I feel like this is sort of Montaigne's sort of secondhand digestion of the Platonism that had been reintroduced through the humanist endeavor. That kind of that kind of you know, and it's a bit, but it's a bit of a double shot too, because traditional, you know, Latin Christian theology had a huge dose of Platonism, thanks to its heritage as a thought system that arose out of late antiquity in the Roman Mediterranean, which itself was, you know, in which Platonism and Neoplatonism were hugely influential schools of thought, but things sort of getting this fresh dose, you know, on top of that. Right. There's this kind of, the, you know, and of course Plato is famous for, making the argument that the shape of God is a sphere.
Yeah.
Kind of, but there's this kind of, this like, well, if we keep imagining the ultimate, you eventually have to get to something that is inert.
Yeah.
That is unchanging. And actually that's, I think that's one of the points that Montaigne makes maybe a little later, that, you know, sort of illustrating how ill-equipped mankind is to understand anything, that not only can he cannot, you know, changing man can't even comprehend changing things, much less the unchanging.
Yeah. That, Plato thought it was a sphere. What was it? The Epicurean? No. I can't remember. I lost my notes on this. One group thought it was a triangle.
I think the Pythagoreans had it as a pyramid. Yeah.
And then, you know, everybody has a shape for the divine. And he's like, how?
Yeah. Montaigne's going like, we got to go one deeper. You got to get rid of your shape, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's about at this point that he starts digging into the Pyrrhonians, and there's this sort of long passage here. Now, the Pyrrhonians make their faculty of judgment so unbending and upright that it registers everything and bestows its assent on nothing. This leads to their well-known ataraxia, that is a claim, that is a calm, stable rule of life, free from all the disturbances caused by the impress of opinions or of such knowledge of reality as we think we have, which give birth to fear, acquisitiveness, envy, immoderate desires, ambition, pride, superstition, love of novelty, rebellion, disobedience, obstinacy, and the greater part of our bodily ills. In this way, they even free themselves from passionate sectarianism, for their disputes are mild affairs, and they are never afraid of the other side having its say. When they assert that heavy things tend to fall downwards, they would be most upset if you believed them. They want you to contradict them in order to achieve their end. Doubt and suspense of judgment. They only put forward propositions of their own in order to oppose the ones they think we believe in. Accept theirs, and they will gladly maintain the opposite. It is all the same to them. They take no sides. If you maintain that snow is black, they will argue that it is, on the contrary, white. If you say that it is neither, their task is to say that it is both. If you conclude that you definitely know nothing, they will maintain that you do know something. Yes, and if you present your doubt as axiomatic, they will challenge you on that too, arguing that you are not in doubt, or that you cannot decide for certain, and prove that you are in doubt. This is doubt taken to its limits. It shakes its own foundations. Such extremes of doubt separate them completely from many other theories, including those which in many ways do indeed teach doubt and ignorance. I've had whole courses that were like that.
Yeah.
You know, graduate school in many cases is that. But what, you know, he's opening up this possibility that this state of doubt, or this state of radically accepting radical doubt, leads you to this kind of calm where you stop thinking about it so much.
Right. You think yourself into recognizing that you shouldn't bother thinking about it. Essentially. Yeah.
So it's an acceptance of that instability, which becomes stabilizing in some way, he seems to claim.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm not quite sure I buy that. You know?
It's a very, well, I mean, you know, we're getting into like very rarefied territory anyway. With all this, and it's like, and I guess this sort of goes back to his, you know, his proposition at the top of the whole piece that, like, look, not everyone can do this, you know, because I think, I don't know of any sort of historical, I don't know enough about any, say, historical Pyrrhonist communes or what have you, if there were any out there where everyone still managed to physically provide for themselves whilst in this Zen state, this Nirvana state.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like there would have to be some perturbation to get you to go ahead and go out there and pick beans or what have you. or maybe not. You know, that's just me having gotten nowhere near art ataxia or whatever it was called. Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I'm not quite entirely sure that I buy that, because on the one hand, that does seem so much a part of his project and so much a part of his humanizing. When I recognize my own fallibility, when I recognize the limitations of my human knowledge, then I can kind of let go of some of the pretense, accept certain things as they are, and work with them to the best of my abilities. And what I can't work with, I just have to let go. Okay. On the other hand, it doesn't really set you up for modifying injustices, things that you see that are really problematic, that need change. And it's almost like this method of radical doubt just allows them to go with the flow, which, you know, given his context, I suppose is probably the best he could hope for. I mean, I think we were talking last time about just how tumultuous his times were.
Right, right. And that sort of ties in with his, you mentioned earlier, like his kind of, his politics veering between these sort of poles of, if not radicalism, then a kind of, a more liberalized sort of vision and just outright conservatism. And I think that probably has a lot to do with having to navigate this extremely disrupted time, because I think what's – and what I think contributes to just how disrupted this time was, and I think people nowadays are so used to the world which this time created that they really underestimate just how much was up in the air, not just church authority with the Protestant Reformation, but also what secular authority could mean. Because so many of these reforming movements turned to the worldly princes to basically rubber stamp them, to provide them with their authority to enact these reforms, you know. And so that was so the roles of what we might call the state, you know, which is a little bit of an anachronistic term at this time. Yeah. It might be better to say, like, you know, secular authority or the commonwealth, the king, right? You know, the king or the prince. What role they might have in the world, that was all being negotiated, all of it. All of it was being negotiated in a very violent way.
Yeah. And it brings me back in some ways to our discussion of Molière, where, you know, at the end of the day, he needs to have the king come on stage and say, hey, everybody out of the water, here's where it comes down. There has to be some kind of final authority.
Right.
Montaigne's final authority. This seems dangerous to me. Or dangerous for him. Montaigne's final authority is going to be God.
Right.
Which I guess you could say the same of the Calvinists.
Exactly. That's what really struck me, is that's the Lutheran position, right? That's right. That's really and it kind of goes back to what Luther was drawing on was first articulated by Augustine. You know, that, you know, we think of Augustine, we think like, oh, well, you know, I mean, he's the Catholic's Catholic, right? I mean, everyone knows St. Augustine, the church, you know, elevates him, and, you know, but there was a real tension in Augustine's works between, because he was himself like very pro organized church, but he also had this vision of humanity as inherently what came to be that kind of Calvinist, what we associate most with the Calvinist tradition, the kind of pervasively corrupt, that that the human being was so totally helpless before the might of God that it was only the only person who you could not initiate your own salvation. You could not initiate your own spiritual awakening. God had to decide to do that to you.
Right.
And that was Luther's big point. That was the whole thing. He was basing a lot of his stuff on, and that was what he would point to, though. Luther himself would be like, look, I didn't say this. God said it. You know, like, and also God told me to say that because I couldn't believe that until God told me to. Yeah. So like Montaigne is, you know, he threaded the needle brilliantly through all of this, but at the same time, like he's supposedly refuting these Lutheran challenges to the Thomist natural philosophy tradition by playing footsie with some very Lutheran concepts of authority.
Well, yeah. And then, okay, let's keep going with the issue of authority. Later on, he starts talking about authority and tradition. He says, merely human opinions become accepted when derived from ancient beliefs and are taken on authority and trust like religion or law. We parrot whatever opinions are commonly held, accepting them as truths, with all the paraphernalia of supporting arguments and proofs, as though they were something firm and solid. Nobody tries to shake them. Nobody tries to refute them. On the contrary, everybody vies with each other to plaster over the cracks and prop up received beliefs with all his powers of reason, mm-hmm. a supple instrument which can be turned on the lathe into any shape at all. Thus the world is pickled in stupidity and brimming over with lies. That seems like the Mark Twain Montaigne.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right? He goes on lambasting just the very idea of blindly accepting past laws. We do not doubt much because commonly received notions are assayed by nobody. We never try to find out whether the roots are sound. We argue about the branches. We do not ask whether any statement is true, but what it has been taken to mean. We ask whether Galen said this or said that. We never ask whether he said anything valid. That sounds exactly like Cornpone Opinions, the Mark Twain essay.
And that's also a refutation of the humanist effort.
Right. No. But then he also later wants to say that it's better to go ahead than to try to, I guess, subvert the established order.
Yeah.
So how do you square this?
I think that's the real honestly, that's the Zen Cohen of Montaigne here that he's presented. I mean, that's the honestly, like I in having this conversation with you, Claude, I have, you know, when you're actually reading it, and I guess we should say the experience of reading it can get pretty tedious.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should stress this. And still, I mean, the animal part's fun. But like the actual, like, especially when it gets deep in the weeds on Pyrrhonism, it gets a little much. But at the same time, there's always like little, he's a one-liner, Montaigne.
Yeah.
So just about every paragraph has like a little like turn of phrase and you're like, oh, hell yeah. You know, I got you, bro. I'm on board. But that's that rhetoric, right? It's that use of rhetoric to make, he almost uses rhetoric to make the argument that you can't make arguments because you're a human. And at the same, so that leads you to, that's like, well then what are we doing here, man? What are you doing spilling all this ink for?
Yeah.
But it's fascinating that it all goes, he falls back on this notion of, you know, the only way we can ever know anything is because of God. And that's honestly how this is how he's defending the Thomist stance, that you can know truths about God through the natural world. Also, it's because he ends up making the argument that Sabanda is right, because you can find out about the nature of ultimate reality and God through observing the natural world, but that's because God is working through you to illuminate that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the way he kind of, that's his squaring of the circle, I guess. Which doesn't, I mean, I don't know. It's, is it convincing after 60 pages of this, like, you know, being buffeted this way and that, like, you know, is it a kind of, you know, is it the kind of thing where you're convinced just by sheer exhaustion by this point? Or,
I don't know. I mean, okay, I almost want to say there's something Stevensian about this. There's something that reminds me of Wallace Stevens, where it's almost like, if we ever get to Stevens, I'll point this out in Stevens' poetry, he's very dialectical, but through symbolic content. So you sort of have to navigate and bob and weave and figure it out. And a lot of times in his best poems, he comes to the conclusion that he can't come to a conclusion, that he's exhausted all possibilities as he sees them for the moment. And the only thing to do is to stop for right now and wait for the next poem.
Yeah.
I think for Stevens, there's always going to be that next poem going on down the road. And the one thing that I find in Montaigne, you know, he sets his authority on the supernatural, but he also sets his authority on himself.
Mm-hmm.
This is another one of those great paradoxical moments. This very awareness, he writes a lot about how he's aware that he changes his mind all the time. And he says, this very awareness of my mutability has had the secondary effect of engendering a certain constancy in my opinions. I have hardly changed any of my first and natural ones, since whatever likelihood novelty may appear to have, I do not change easily, for fear of losing in the exchange. As I do not have the capacity for making a choice myself, I accept another's choice and remain where God put me. Otherwise, I would not know how to save myself from endlessly rolling. I think in some ways that's the heart of this essay, that it's the very fact that I'm so easily swayed, which makes me realize at the end of the day, I'm so extraordinarily constant. My one constant attribute is that you can always sway my opinion. It's that sort of paradox at the heart of it, because I'm so easily taken, I may as well just stay where I am.
Yeah.
Many's the time I've taken an opinion contrary to my own and, as I am fond of doing, tried defending it for the fun of the exercise. Then, once my mind has really applied itself to that other side, I get so firmly attached to it that I forget why I held the first opinion and gave it up. Almost any inclination, no matter which, takes me with it and carries me along by my own weight. Almost anybody could say much the same of himself if he watched himself, as I do. Preachers know that the emotion which comes upon them as they speak moves them towards belief. And if we know that when we are in a temper, we devote ourselves to defending an assertion, impressing it upon ourselves, and embracing it with furious approbation far more than we ever do in cold-blooded calm. We only really believe things because we believe things.
Yeah.
The opposite could just as easily be true. So where does that leave us?
It leaves us with 60 pages and what do we have is a guy shrugging his shoulders saying, oh, but not really. Cause I do think though there's a solid point he's trying to make. And shockingly for Montaigne, I think he actually does like wrap it up at the last bit. So if you'll permit me, I'm going to read sort of the last, last paragraph.
That's exactly where I was going.
Okay. Yeah. And this is, I read this actually as kind of another direct shot across the bow at the humanists, which he is such a part of that tradition. But another part of the humanist tradition was, look at these great achievements and the great works of the people of classical antiquity. Human beings can improve themselves. It was, you know, is one of the basic tenets of the humanist ideal. And you had people like Desiderius Erasmus, you know, the big humanist guy of the time. He was very excited about like, hey, we're going to be able to build better societies, aren't we? Of course, he himself was bitterly disappointed with the direction everything went by the time of his death. But anyway, so Montaigne wraps this all up, you know, in my edition, like, you know, 60, 70 pages. He says, to this so religious conclusion of a pagan, you know, sort of theoretical, you know, pagan thought, I shall only add this testimony of one and the same condition for the close of this long and tedious discourse. Thanks, thanks, Montaigne, which would furnish me with endless matter. Quote, oh, what a vile and abject thing, says he, is man if he does not raise himself above humanity, end quote. 'Tis a good word and a profitable desire, but withal absurd. For to make the handful bigger than the hand, and the armful larger than the arm, and to hope to stride further than our legs can reach, is impossible and monstrous. Or that man should rise above himself and humanity, for he cannot see but with his eyes, nor sees but with his power. He shall rise if God will extraordinarily lend him his hand. He shall rise by abandoning and renouncing his own proper means, and by suffering himself to be raised and elevated by means purely celestial. It belongs to our Christian faith, and not to his stoical virtue, to pretend that divine and miraculous metamorphosis.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's, I was astonished to read that, and that would be the concluding thought, because I was like, well, damn it, Montaigne, you actually had a concluding thought there, didn't you? But I really, but I did really love that, like, this sort of the, like, oh, you know, like, what is the noblest thing for a human being to do? Well, to strive to surpass his humanity. And I just love that image of, like, what? To make the handful bigger than the hand? You can't. You're human. You're human. You have to face that fact. You'll never be more than human. That's what you're working with.
Right.
But he leaves open, of course, the possibility, thanks to his Christian faith, there is the possibility of becoming more than the fallen, wretched creature that you are, thanks to the grace of God. And exclusively the grace of God, which, while being an orthodox position, sort of officially because Augustine said so, it was actually the kind of position that led to the heterodox, you know, reformations all over the place when people were like, hey, it turns out I don't have to do this mass stuff, do I? Yeah. You know, that has no bearing on what's happening. Yeah.
So that's a sort of fascinating paradox that keeps, you know, popping back and forth within this essay, you know, using Lutheranism to refute Lutheranism and
and humanism to undermine humanism. And it's I think more than anything else, this is one of those, like, damn, Montaigne really was a man of his time kind of works, because I think it encapsulates that that upending,
yeah,
that was sort of convulsing the, you know, Western European societies at that point, and mostly, you know, I guess we should stress mostly in the sort of the upper echelons. You know, this is of course also the time of, you know, the great bargain that was struck in the Holy Roman Empire was like, okay, look, whatever the prince of your particular dukedom or whatever decides, that's what you are. So we need to recall that in all of this, like, it was a massive upending of society in, you know, in a lot of ways, but it, you know, people still had to go out and take care of the oxen and, you know, and sow the wheat and all that. But at the same time, though, I mean, you know, everyone on the street knew that this was, you know, big things were afoot.
And I was
I was reading it that I realized, like, well, shit, like, Montaigne in this. And this endlessly, diverting and paradoxical and self-refuting essay, he's encapsulating this sort of free fall, this intellectual and spiritual free fall that the Latin West is kind of experiencing.
Yeah,
And his prescription is, you know, this kind of nirvana state, which is impossible to achieve, probably.
Well, it. This, as much as we've been talking about deconstruction, this seems to me closer to Montaigne the modernist.
Mm-hmm.
That I think you're accurate in describing him as sort of recording that radical shift that's occurring in Western Europe at the time. That real undermining of certain kinds of theological or philosophical authorities, and this desire to find some kind of stability, some kind of mental stability that allow you to rest. I think Montaigne finds stability in instability, and it's that paradoxical aspect of it that seems extraordinarily modernist to me. One more time, that seems so much in line with something like Stevens that, you know, I can't get it out of my head now. But yeah. But there's also that aspect of it. We're human. Don't try to be more than human.
Yeah.
You're not going to get that far. That's something to keep in mind as we move further down the line into something like Faust, where the whole point is to move beyond the human. And we can even think about our own time and the competing claims right now about extending the human or even, you know, genetically altering the human so that the human is not human anymore.
Right.
Quote unquote, perfecting the species. When we try to become more than what we are, disaster seems to follow.
Yeah.
And yet, should we not also be hopeful for change at certain moments? I can keep doing this all night.
and so could Montaigne. But I think that's probably a good place for us to wrap it up for this time.
So yeah, there are other essays in here that were really sort of that were fascinating in their own right that I think deserve reading. I found his essay on fathers and sons, or not even fathers and sons, on fathers and their children to be really kind of fascinating in its own right. Just because a lot of it did have to do with his relationship to his own father. The essay on cruelty I thought was really kind of interesting because that's the one that reminds you that he's living in the middle of basically all-out war at any given moment.
Yeah.
And he's sort of cringing at the horrible things that we do to each other.
Yeah.
Freedom of conscience was one that hit me. And then, what was the other one? Yeah. On thumbs.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the middle of this, there's a lot of his, you know, wild, bizarre spinning and stuff like that. But, and the apology for Raymond Sebone is the sort of centerpiece of all this. But there's some good sort of like sorties off to the side here and there that deserve thinking about. We just don't have time to do it right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess we'll be finishing up next time with book three. And we'll just dive into that as we can.
Yeah. We'll see what tickles our fancy here. And you know, if it's another deep dive into the absolute mires of epistemology and theology, then damn it, that's what we'll do. But hopefully it'll be a change of pace. We'll see.
Yeah, I really hope not. All right. So do we have a social media presence?
We will have more of one when I remember my login information for the Twitter account that I set up. I actually forgot which email I used for that. Apologies, everyone. I will figure that out. Cannonball Pod, at Cannonball Pod is, the erstwhile, Twitter presence there. I will, again, once I remember the login info, or recover it, I will, be a little more active there. You know, we'll always be tweeting out links to new shows. And, if I see anything cool related to, you know, what we're doing, I'll try to work it out there. So be on the lookout for that, or possibly a different handle if I can't remember how to get into that one.
And we've also got the blog still up, and I'm gonna be updating that in a bit.
Yeah.
The Cannonball Podcast at WordPress. And so I'm gonna try and get some more extended writings over there. In particular, we did a crossover episode a while back with some of the Agora podcast members. Well, I did. You had to take out sick.
But I did a crossover, sadly so, yes.
Episode on who's greater, Aragorn from Lord of the Rings or Jon Snow from Song of Fire and Ice, Game of Thrones. And I don't really know either work that well, but I held my own. And what fascinated me, well, I like to think I held my own, but what fascinated me were some of the differences between the two works that seemed to line up in how we might could think about modern and postmodern literature. Yeah. Though I hesitate to use these large isms and things like that, et cetera, et cetera. So I was going to try and map some of those out on the blog.
Yeah,
and if anybody's
cool.
interested, you know, that might be up there. So anyway, I think, like Montaigne at the end of this essay claims to be, I am mentally exhausted. So
absolutely. Let us, you know, I'm gonna turn my brain off. I'm gonna engage in some ataraxia, and I'm just gonna zen out for a while, man.
I'm gonna go to sleep.
Sounds good.
So I'll see you later, and thank you very much for listening.